William Kentridge has earned international acclaim for his interdisciplinary works of art, which fuse drawing, film, and theater to explore the themes of colonialism, social conflict, personal and cultural memory, and loss and reconciliation in his native South Africa. William Kentridge, Five Themes, a comprehensive survey of his work over the past three decades, is on view at the Museum of Modern Art through May 17th. And Mr. Kentridge has also staged and directed The Nose, an opera by Dmitri Shostakovich, based on a story by Nikolai Gogol. It is being performed at the Metropolitan Opera through March 25th. I'm very pleased to welcome William Kentridge to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Can you describe the process and technique of creating your hand-drawn animations?
Well, the basic process is making charcoal drawings, but instead of making thousands of different drawings the way you would with traditional cell animation, there are a few drawings. Each sequence is one drawing, and the making of the film consists of a walk between the sheet of paper on the wall and the camera in the middle of the studio, and a drawing is done and two frames are shot, and then I'll alter the drawing, erasing and adding to it, shoot two more frames. And so during the course of a day or a week, there are these hundreds of walks between the drawing and the camera and hundreds of alterations to the drawing. And in the end, the drawing that's left at the end is the final image of the sequence.
And I'd imagine the paper has gotten rather thinned out by all
well,
the erasing.
There are different papers, some which survive, some which don't.
Did you begin by wanting to be a graphic artist or a filmmaker?
I began by wanting to do everything, I think. And then friends advised me that if I wanted to do everything, I would succeed at none and needed to specialize. And for many years, I tried to follow that very bad advice. And it took me a long time to realize that temperamentally, that was not going to be possible.
When you begin a film, do you know where the drawings are going to lead you? Do you use a storyboard?
No, there's no script or storyboard for the project. It's important that there isn't. But there's some idea, there's an image, there's a theme, there's a kind of an area of the world I want to explore. Usually that means there's some phrases written in a book and that there are a couple of images that I know I'll start drawing.
So you're not surprised by where things lead? Somebody.
No, the hope is to try to make strategies to make a place for surprise.
How long does it usually take to complete an animation?
Well, I suppose a 9-minute film would take the better part of a year.
Really? And you've made quite a few films.
I've been working for many, many years.
Do you put it all together at once?
No, it doesn't.
What is the editing process
the,
like?
The process is that after a few weeks, I'll start showing it to an editor. So when I say a few weeks, it's maybe a minute of film. Mm-hmm. And I'll start showing it to a composer, and we'll start listening to different pieces of music to see how that affects what we're seeing of the drawings. And I'll start after, I suppose, 3 or 4 weeks when there are a couple of different shots done working with an editor. What does it mean if the one's in front of the other or we reverse the order? And from that, from that process, the editing process, but also from the drawing process, there are possibilities and suggestions and other images that suggest themselves, and it gradually gets coherent.
Because there's no straight narrative in these works.
They end up with a narrative, but they don't start with a narrative. So three-quarters of the way through, I'll say, right, to get this film to make sense, we need to see a cat at the very beginning of the film, because we see it at the end, but no one knows where it comes from. And in fact, the cat and the telephone, we've got a telephone on his desk, so if we turn the cat into a telephone, then later on when they see the telephone, they'll understand there's a cat still somewhere hidden inside it. So as the film progresses, there are certain functional drawings and sequences which I know I need to make the narrative work, to give it the grammar, but also sometimes connections of images which I hadn't anticipated.
Your drawing style has remained relatively consistent over all those years.
There are different styles. There's a way of working with charcoal, which is the films we've been describing. Recently I've mainly been drawing with torn paper, putting together fragments of torn paper scraps till you recognize some object or image in them and working with that. But essentially, it's old-fashioned drawing.
What's the story you're telling in the series, Ubu Tells the Truth? What relationship does it have to Alfred Jarry's classic absurdist play from 1896?
The Ubu project was done in 1985-86, for the centenary of Jarry's writing of Ubuwa, his story of the bombastic tyrant, Père Ubu. And it was done then at the time that we had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, just after our first democratic elections in 1994. And the idea was to kind of smash these two things together, this absurd form of the Jarry, together with the very extraordinary testimonies at the commission to see how could one put together archival documentary material with this very crude way of drawing. Did the one destroy the veracity of the other? And in fact, we found the closer they were together, the more they worked. So you have this very a mixture of archival footage of actual testimonies and a very crude cartoon-like depiction of violence. And I think the success of the piece is that they strengthen rather than weaken each other.
We have done any number of segments on this show discussing the Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearings, and they were controversial because people weren't ultimately punished. What was your feeling?
I mean, it was a compromise, and that was a compromise we had with the whole transformation. And the compromise was to say, we cannot have both truth and justice, and would we rather have truth but know that we're not going to get justice? In other words, they tried to have a trial of one of the generals, and it took 3 years, but there was not the resources to begin to do a Nuremberg trials of everybody in the country. And the choice was then rather to say, well, what is most important is to actually understand what happened. And the only way to do that was to offer amnesty to people who had been the perpetrators of these crimes. In exchange for full disclosure, they would get amnesty. So the central irony of the South African transformation was that as you heard more and more terrible things that people had done, so they got closer and closer to being given amnesty for it. So we did. It was a clear trade which has a lot of implications and costs, even
especially
now.
For the victims.
Well, a lot of certainly for the victims, the victims who were killed have no recompense. For a lot of the families of victims, it was important to know what had happened to family members, and this is a way of actually knowing what had happened, how they dealt with the fact that the person sitting across them said that they had been responsible for their child's death is extraordinary.
In your earlier work, which was done during the apartheid period, first of all, was that shown in South Africa?
Yes, in South Africa there was a kind of a liberal intolerance. There was a sense in which it wasn't a totalized state. There were lots of cracks. They needed to believe, the national government needed to believe that they were part of a democracy, their own particular crazy kind, but that was their belief. So it was within the world of visual arts, it was very difficult to have work stopped. Within the world of television and news, there was very strict censorship. But in the world of theater and a few novels were banned, some novels were banned. But I think the only work of art that was banned was a drawing by a South African artist showing Christ wearing a Christmas hat, which was banned for blasphemy.
Well, so many of the writers of the time, Alan Paton, Nadine Gordimer, Andre Brink, Athel Fugard, Breiten Breitenbach, they all gained international recognition, which I assume was embarrassing. Some of them told me that they did feel threatened at different times during their lives.
I mean, there's people like Breiten Breitenbach spent many years in prison. Some of them did, but they kept writing in South Africa for the most part, producing an extraordinary body of work over those years.
One image that frequently appears in your work is the rock. I'm assuming that's a metaphor for apartheid. Or am I being too simplistic? Because people straining under the weight of the rock or some other heavy load appearing pretty frequently.
There are rocks. At one point I had an image in my head of the comfort of a stone, which is kind of not the same image. There's an image of one of the characters sleeping with his head on a stone. So that was one version of it. I don't think the rock was ever done as an allegory, saying this is a symbol of apartheid. This is a symbol of it. I knew very early on that to try to say we're going to do the big definitive story of apartheid doesn't work at all. The only hope is to approach it obliquely, to work in much more personal, less direct ways. Because otherwise that the monolith of the state and trying to depict it within an artwork becomes impossible.
My guest is William Kentridge. The exhibit at the Museum of Modern Art, William Kentridge 5 Themes. His also has a very handsome catalog with a DVD inside, and that would be important in your case because so much of this work is animated. If you want to get a sense of what it looks like still, we will have a slideshow of some of the images on our show page at WNYC.org. I think we're putting that up as we speak. You've also created a series of animations about three fictional characters, Soho Eckstein, his wife, and Felix Teitelbaum. And I imagine that they represent different aspects of you and your experience.
In retrospect, I think one can say that they do. When I was making them, they're three fictional characters that go through performing. It's like a troupe of commedia dell'arte actors. They get pressed into service in innumerable different stories and scripts and situations that they have to play out. But I think it's important to understand the stupidity of making art, that all of these kind of questions, do they represent parts of myself? In retrospect, maybe they do. While making them, that is the last question you're thinking about. You think, how do I get the shoulder to fit onto the elbow? How does the is this jacket too dark? I've messed up the shape of his lapel while trying to move the hand across. It's a series of very specific practical questions you're solving, at the end of which there is a meaning, but that's kind of not the concern while doing it.
Although Felix makes drawings, so you had to have been aware of that connection. Or is that just allow you to do a drawing?
No, Felix is surrounded by drawings, and he looks in the mirror and sees the woman in the mirror, not his own face. It's very difficult to say. No, I mean, that was not the thought going through my. Many of the things which are completely patent and obvious when you look at the films finished are invisible while making it.
They also have musical soundtracks, and the soundtracks are very effective. How did you choose the music?
I work a lot with the South African composer Philip Miller, and for the most part of the work on the exhibition, the Five Themes exhibition, is his music. And it's, you know, he's a wonderful composer, and he's in Johannesburg. So as soon as a film starts, or I have an idea, within half an hour we can be together talking through possibilities, listening to different fragments of music. I can take the first minute of film to his studio, and he'll improvise or listen to different music. So it's very much a conversation that doesn't happen at the end but happens all the way through the making. The music's interest important because both, you know, in the most obvious way, and one expects a mood from music, but also in terms of a grammar, where the music starts and stops is kind of cause and effect, helps you to read the narrative. But the third way, and the most important way, is that different music makes you see the images differently. So if you have no music, sometimes an image is too jerky to actually sit with. The animation is so crude. You see such a series of jerky still images. And if you put a particular music with it, it becomes smooth. Your eye sees it in a very different way.
It helps us in the transitions.
It helps with, yeah.
Well, the exhibit is almost all drawings, prints, and of course these projections. Have you ever done paintings?
No, when I started out as an art student in South Africa in the 1970s, the idea was that to be an artist you essentially needed to work with oil on canvas or acrylic on canvas, and that the models of painting were the great American colorists. I mean, Jules Zelitsky, Helen Frankenthaler, Larry Poons, these were kind of the people held as the great hope of painting. And for me, it was a complete pain. It was an anxiety that I was so bad at it that I could not paint a Frankenthaler. I was not interested in painting an Zelitsky.
And there's so little color in this work.
Yeah, well, I mean, so I gave up. I gave up. I said, okay, I have not the right to be an artist. I can't work with color. I can't work with oil paint. I don't want to work with canvas. And it took several years before I came back into the studio and I decided, well, I'm going to make charcoal drawings, whether people like it or not. And if that's being an artist or not being an artist, that's not the question.
And the only color we get is some blue for water and other things, some red, and everything else is black and white. But, you know, it's not all that unusual for people to make the leap from film to theater. When did it happen for you?
Well, it happened in one hand before I was an artist. When I decided I wasn't a painter, I couldn't do any painting. Well, at university, I did both. I worked with a student theater group and worked in the evenings at an art school. But when I gave up being an artist, when I decided I couldn't do paintings, I shouldn't be an artist, I went to theater school in Paris for a year to see if I should be an actor. And I was a very bad actor, so I understood I should not be an actor.
Although your characters are actors.
I was happy to be a director, but I was no good as an actor. And haven't acted again until, you know, the last year when I started doing these performance pieces. But came back, so I started making the drawings, and then from the drawings I started filming the drawings, and then decided to work with a theater company saying, what happens if we put the animated projections together with their wooden puppets? And then we added actors to the puppets, and then we subtracted the puppets, and suddenly there were a group of actors or singers on stage, And I was back doing theater, which I hadn't expected at all.
Is that what led the Metropolitan Opera to invite you to put together this production of
The
Nose?
Well, I think that I'd done a couple of other operas. I'd done a chamber opera with puppets, with the Handspring Puppet Company, the great South African puppet company. And on the strength of that, I'd been invited by an opera house in Brussels, Théâtre de la Monnaie, to do a magic flute.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Peter Gelb had either heard of or seen that production and started a conversation, let's see if there's a project that works for them and for me to do.
And I'm assuming that the exhibit at MoMA was scheduled to coincide with this production.
Yes, I think what happened was that the exhibition was in preparation for a long time, and the conversation with the Metropolitan Opera had been going for a while. And then there was a very clear desire on my part to see if they could amplify each other, if the exhibition is a way of seeing a larger and wider body of work than the opera, but the opera also becomes one of the exhibits, parts of the exhibition. So they've been astonishing, the two institutions, in being happy to coordinate and work together.
Well, the Nose seems like a perfect match for you. Is this something you chose, or did the Met choose it?
No, the Met chose. There'd been many operas which they'd suggested which didn't work for me, from Attila to different Contori. There were different ones that were great operas, but just didn't provoke me. And at one point, Peter Gelb suggested a different Shostakovich project, and I wrote back to saying, I would love to do Shostakovich, but first prize, not expecting it to be possible, would be to do The Nose. And to my delight, he spoke to his conductor and said, well, let's do it.
Do you see certain similarities between the absurdities of Tsarist Russia and apartheid South Africa?
I do. I mean, it's not done as an... I think that what the absurdities of South African apartheid society did with its... which has to do with a kind of fundamental illogic somewhere in the beginning. And this illogic is then followed very rigorously to the nth degree. And that, in a way, is a very good definition of the absurd. So the South African society led me to understand that the absurd is not a mistake at the edge of a society, but sometimes built right into the heart of it. And certainly you had in Russia and the Soviet Union a sense of language being disengaged, where lies weren't about not telling the truth, but about being strategic. And suddenly that left you in the land where no one knew quite what was being said or why anything was being done or what the logic was. And so that sense, the absurd as a form which isn't about private tragedy, but which is about a dislocation in society, seems to me an apt way of describing many societies, many elements of contemporary society, not just dislocations within the Soviet Union. But also for me, The Nose is interesting in that it's not just a critique, it's also a celebration of the possibilities of transformation that the 1917 revolution unleashed. So the production has to function both as a celebration of the possibilities that were crashed, that were destroyed, and also an elegy for those promises that didn't work out.
Now, pretty much all the reviewers have declared the opera a great work of art. How was it received when it was first performed in 1930?
Well, I think it was received very well. So I think there were about 10 performances. I may be wrong, but my memory is that there were about 10 performances, and then it was stopped. Then the word came down. And then it was next, I think it was...
This is early Stalin.
This is 1930, so it's Mayakovsky's already committed suicide. Meyerhold only gets arrested and shot 10 years later. The writer of the Soviet Writers' Congress is 1934, when socialist realism becomes the official doctrine. So it's in a space, a very contested space, when you had different people saying we need to make proletarian art, and other people say we need to have all possibilities for the artist is the way of demonstrating the freedoms.
We don't have much time, but I was wondering if your multi-screen piece at MoMA, I Am Not Me, The Horse Is Not Mine, is a kind of preparation for the staging of The Nose.
It was a preparation for the staging, and it also is able to include kind of the retrospective look back. So it has part of the text of Bukharin's trial before the plenum of the Central Committee, which happens in the 1930s. But it has within that a kind of absurd illogic, which gets foreshadowed in Gogol, 1837, his view of an absurd world.
So we keep on coming back to that word absurd. Alfred Jarry, probably the creator of the theater of the absurd, the absurdity of totalitarianism, of race laws. I guess would you say that's a major theme?
I think it is an important theme because it's trying to find what is a way of representing the world which in its own way, in fact, is accurate. So it's not the absurd as an escape from reality. it's understanding the world as the illogic, the dislocations in the world, in which the form of the absurd is an accurate way of drawing them. It becomes a strange naturalism.
William Kentridge's exhibit at the Museum of Modern Art, William Kentridge Five Themes, is running now through the 17th of May. His staging of the opera The Nose, Dmitri Shostakovich's opera based on the story by Nikolai Gogol, will be at the Metropolitan Opera through March 25th, and it has been my great pleasure to talk to him today.
Thank you.